Hi, this is Hugh. We are sitting at a restaurant. What neighborhood would you say this is in?
We're smack dab in the middle of WeHo.
You're in the West middle
Hollywood.
Of WeHo.
Yeah, West Hollywood.
So we're north of where I talked to Suzanne Goyne, and I'm sitting in front of Michael Cimarusti, who just won Best Chef. What is it called? Not Pacific. Is it California? West. West. It's West.
It's West, but it's... Honestly, it should be just called California because it includes Las Vegas and Hawaii.
Right.
But I can't even remember the last time.
But what a seminal roster of chefs this year.
And every year. It's like, it's always Murderer's Row.
It is Murderer's Row, but this year was so different and eclectic. And I love seeing Jessica Coslow on the ticket because I think what she's done with Squirrel is so different in food and success and breakfast and lunch place. But we're sitting in Connie and Ted's. And Connie and Ted's is a, like Providence, a fish-forward restaurant.
Yeah.
Unlike Providence,
seafood restaurant.
It ain't your fancy pants place.
No, it's not at all.
It's not.
No.
So tell me about Connie and Ted's first.
Well, Connie and Ted's, first of all, the first thing you need to know is it's named after my grandparents, Constance and Edward Poynton.
Constance,
but she always went by Connie. No, maybe her mother would call her Constance when she was in trouble, but but I always knew her as Connie or Grandma, and... Right. You know, and they were from both, you know, born in England, but moved to New England at a very young age and settled in Rhode Island and lived in Rhode Island their whole lives. And you know, the restaurant comes from them. Honestly, like I spent tons of time there when I was a kid, like all the holidays.
Were they in Providence?
They were in Providence and Pawtucket.
Okay.
And but, you know, all the holidays we'd spend there, we'd go there in the summertime. We'd have a house in... Narragansett, Rhode Island.
Yep.
And we would spend the summer at the beach and, you know,
lobstering, crabbing, all that sort of thing.
Fishing with my grandfather, you know, eating clam cakes, eating fried clams, eating lobster rolls, and just like absolutely, you know, fell in love with it. I mean, every aspect of it. Honestly, like when I look back at my childhood, like the things that I remember most about food are those times when we'd be in New England and we'd go. You know, to, you know, it could be just a simple little shack on a beach, which was often the case, or it could be, you know, like restaurants in downtown Providence that specialized in seafood. And, you know, I remember so many of those meals very, very well, even from when I was a young kid. And then the other side of my family is all Italian. And so, you know, I remember tons about food, you know, with my dad's side of the family as well. It was always about food. It always seemed to be, you know, a six hour meal and then a poker game.
A poker game.
And
for
one of
money
the outer
or
boroughs
for
of Manhattan.
Like,
yeah, it was always for money, and you couldn't play unless you had a job. So that usually precluded me.
That's probably the best rule of thumb when it comes to poker, is you can't play unless you have a job.
Exactly.
That's awesome. So, and Connie and Ted's opened up when?
2000. What is now? Now is
19.
I think it was 14 or 13 we opened up.
Okay.
I think it was maybe, I think it was 13 because this year we're 6 years old.
Do you have two of them now?
No, just one.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, I guess I was looking on a map and it was like Santa Monica. I kept thinking Santa Monica.
Santa Monica Boulevard.
Yeah, Santa Monica Boulevard.
That's why.
And then Providence opened up 13 years ago.
05, yeah.
05.
Yeah.
So what was, I mean, Providence was your first restaurant.
Right.
I mean, you went for high-end, you've got a proclivity and a love for seafood. Providence was positioned to be the fine dining seafood restaurant of L.A.
Absolutely.
Right out of the gate. Mm-hmm. I mean, how does all that happen?
Like, it just, honestly, I mean, it's super organic, you know? Like, I've always been a fisherman. I've always been in love with it. Always been in love with, you know, being on the water. And, you know... I mean, I just, so many memories of, like, you know, being with my dad or my grandfather, like, up in places like, for instance, Galilee, Rhode Island, this beautiful little fishing village. You know, I spent a lot of time there. And so I don't know, it's just always had a hold on me, you know, the sea. And so, you know, through the years, obviously, working in restaurants, I wound up cooking a lot of fish. You know, I spent almost 2 years on the fish station at Lasirik in New York when I was a young kid. That made a huge impression on me.
That must have been a crazy restaurant to work in.
It was crazy restaurant.
So who was chefing then at Lasirik?
Sylvain Porte.
Okay.
And and so
where is Sylvain Porte now?
Sylvain Porte, he wound up moving out here for a long time.
Okay.
He still is out here, I believe. But he, you know, after he left Lasirik, he became the executive chef of the Ritz-Carlton in San Francisco. of the dining room.
Which is a very pedigreed place. I mean, Gary Danko was chef there for a long time, and then Ron Siegel was chef there for eons.
Yes.
Ron Siegel, the chef who never really wanted to work in a restaurant, just in a hotel.
Yeah.
We never understood that because the guy's weird. Badass.
Yeah, he was a badass.
But now, I guess now he's, where is he? He's in Aqua.
Know. Oh, is he really?
Yeah, he runs Aqua.
It's
a crazy, weird world.
Yeah, it is.
Mostly California chefs in that way. It's weird.
But so, I think Sylvain mainly focuses on making wine now.
Okay.
He makes wine with Laurent Memrique.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he and the two of them. He and Laurent, they have their own labels.
Huh. That's great.
But I mean, he was a great guy. You know, scared the shit out of me for a long, long time when I first started.
The French chefs always did.
Yeah,
he's not a big, portly, imposing man.
No, but he can. But he's got pipes.
Yeah, he's got pipes.
But
those are the old days. I don't think he can use those pipes you're used to.
No, you're right.
A lawsuit cometh when you use those pipes these days, which is probably a good change.
But he, he just had like very. You know, very exacting standards, and he knew exactly what he wanted. And he knew who could deliver it and who couldn't. You know what I mean? And for a while there, when I first started, I was in the latter category. You know, I wasn't able to deliver, and I knew that. You know, and I knew that it would take a lot of growing in order to be able to hold down a station to be a chef de partie there. But once I got it down, it was great. You know, and I mean, we had a great working relationship, and every time I see him now, it's all hugs and and because. You know, those are the experiences, even though they're incredibly difficult and challenging and trying, and they make you question your motivation and everything.
And your industry, and whether you want to stick in it, and whether you want to be a chef. And
right, but I fall back on everything that I learned there now, every day of my career, honestly. And
which really is an interesting thing. Can in the modern world, because you and I are about kind of in the same age group.
Yeah.
And, we earned our stripes in French kitchens being screamed at. But I don't want to play the old man in this game saying, well, you don't know what it was like back then, ducking pots and getting yelled at. But, I mean, there's got to be a new modern way of earning your stripes in a kitchen where you can retain technique and understanding. And importance of excelling and working on your station with due diligence and making everything right and be, but without having to duck pots.
Right. No, I think there is, and I mean, and I, I'm certainly working towards building, an environment like that for the people that work for me. I remember when I was there, Sylvain was the executive chef, but the chef de cuisine was Sota Kun, who was the thread that ran through, Danielle's, the time that he was there as chef, and also Sylvain, and he was chef de cuisine to both of those chefs, but really the backbone of the kitchen.
He was the epitome of a true chef de cuisine, which is nothing happens without them.
Yeah, he was unbelievable. And then, he was the one that eventually took over when Sylvain left, and he was the last person to earn 4 stars as a chef of Le Cirque as well for the New York Times. And but I mean, that guy, I learned so much from him. And I mean, there were times where we would sit down, he and I were very friendly. I would like house sit for him when he would leave the city and stuff, and he would have, every once in a while, he'd have people over at the end of the night, and we'd go over and talk, and, there'd be downtime. And he would look at us, like the young guys that were in the kitchen. Mostly he would focus on the Americans, because I think the French guys that were in the kitchen just kind of, give up on those guys. Like, he figured, they're going back
to
France.
They're indoctrinated. They're going back to France. Yeah. They're never going to be of use here.
But he would sit there and say, we'd have to get through a Saturday night, and the restaurant was closed on Sunday, but we all worked 6 days a week and 14, 15, 16 hours a day, whatever it was. And he'd, we'd go to his house after a busy Saturday, and everybody would be exhausted. He'd say, it's your generation that has to change this. You are the ones that are going to need to, start a new sort of path on this sort of thing. And I think, I think we're at that point now. I'm not sure if we haven't gone too far to the opposite end of the spectrum. I know that in France they have, for sure, like 35-hour work weeks or whatever it is, and that kind of thing. And that even holds true in restaurants. I mean,
it sounds beautiful though, in a lot of ways.
But it's
insane.
It
is crazy. Yeah.
I mean, I know, like when I worked in France, the place that I worked, we started at 8 o'clock in the morning, and you worked, through lunch, and then you had to clean the kitchen as if you were going home. And if you couldn't get that done by a certain hour, then there was no break, and you rolled right into dinner service, and you'd get they'd let you go at like right before the last train would leave, the metro station, which was basically midnight. So you're talking like, 16-hour days every day. you know, and now I know, you know, that.
Where was that?
That was at Arpège.
Okay.
And I know that restaurant now has two crews. You know, there's a lunch crew, there's a dinner crew.
But that's because funny because Suzanne Goyen worked at Arpège, too.
I know.
Years before you.
Yeah, right around the same time.
Really? Okay. Yeah. Huh.
So it was, you know, insanity. But, you know, and, I'm not quite sure what's better. But I think what is, you know, I had the chance to speak to a bunch of young kids recently about cooking. And, you know, you try to come up with things that sound profound or whatever. But the one thing that I didn't mention to them, which I you know, sort of like came to me after the whole thing was over, was what I should have told them is that you should not expect this to be easy. And I think that's like such an incredible, you know, there's a lot behind that. You know, it's a very simple thing to say, but there's a lot behind that, because I feel like nowadays it seems like the path to success in our industry is really quite easy. You know what I mean? It's paved with things like Instagram and Top Chef and MasterChef and all these other things, where you can very quickly go from a guy that maybe worked for 3 or 4 years in a restaurant, maybe a good restaurant, maybe not a great restaurant, but maybe you've got some individual talent. If you can excel on television and have a great Instagram account and everything else, you may well, you know, find
get enough investors and right location to be successful, regardless of what you're doing in the kitchen and how you're running things.
Right. Near the top of the heap, you know. And I don't know if that's right or wrong. You know what I mean? But I do. Well, I mean, here's the thing. You know, at the end of the day, it all comes down to experience. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, people that rush to success, there are plenty of things that they probably missed along the way. You know what I mean? And then the question is also like, well, is that really important? You know what I mean? Like, was it important that you had pans thrown at your head, or that I did, or actually I never did, but I witnessed it. But, you know, like, sometimes I really don't know anymore.
Yeah,
you know
what I mean? I don't either.
Because
I also
feel like you said, you know, I don't want to be like the old guy. Well, back in my day,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. but it's hard. But it is a really changing industry, and I think that it was really prescient of a lot of people to realize that it was going to change and make you realize that you were going to be on the forefront of that change.
Yeah.
Providence as a restaurant. So you open up in 2013. Where's all the money come from?
No, 2005.
2005, sorry. Yeah, 13 years old, 2005. Yeah. So where's the investment come from? Was it difficult cobbling that together or getting that figured out?
Actually, it wasn't that hard.
Okay.
You know, we have a great lawyer who we still work with today. He's done lots of restaurants. It's pretty much his niche. You know, his first one was actually, or one of the first ones that he did was a French Laundry, but he also did Patina, and
I've heard of a couple other places too.
And then he sort of guided through Joachim through the, you know, the early stages of his career. Helped him grow, helped him build it to what it eventually became. And he's worked with a lot of other chefs that you'd have heard of in Los Angeles and other cities as well. He's a great guy. I mean, he really helped us, sort of like build that framework and also like offer a very, very, sort of like critical look at what we had planned to do and what we had thought. I remember like the first time we walked into his office and we were talking, and you know, this guy that was going to be my partner when we first opened up said, yeah, we're thinking, you know, we'll probably open with about, I don't know, somewhere between $250,000 and $300,000 worth of wine and inventory. And Bob, the guy's name is Bob Sutcliffe. I'm sure you won't mind that I mention his name. Was like, are you insane? You're going to take $300,000 and you're going to lock it away in a wine cellar on the opening day? Are you crazy? What is wrong? You know, these are the kinds of things
that you
build.
What's your wine inventory now, though?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's got up to that.
Yeah, but it took us a while. You know what I mean? Like, what do you really need? What do you, you know, when you first open, you have to think of what your priorities are, you know, and like what's truly important. You know what I mean?
But that's a really good case for and something all young chefs need to learn is you just don't open up like that. You don't open up with a storied wine cellar that's got inventory for going back 100 years, 75 years. It's like you've got to morph into that and prove the worth of the restaurant and the real pro forma of what you created.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it's worthless in the end.
Yeah.
It's going to all go back to auction.
Yeah. So. It was funny because, you know, I just remember sitting there and like, after he had like lambasted us for like 5 or so minutes, I just like took out my pen, like, made a little note. All right. we're gonna take that figure down a bit.
Let's take a zero down off of that.
So funny, you know?
I mean, you can always buy more if you sell it.
Exactly.
And mostly in California, you can buy it at auction. I can't buy it at auction in Georgia. It's one of those three-tier states, and you can't do that. So it's interesting that that lawyer helped Joachim build Patina and build the name and then grow his brand. But you're in the old Patina space.
Yeah.
So
that's a fun story, too.
Is the kitchen the same?
No. We changed it up.
Completely changed it.
Not at the beginning. We kept the kitchen the way it was for a while because he had refurbished the place, about a year and a half before he moved out.
Wow.
Of it. Yeah.
That was lucky.
Yeah. So here's the thing. Like when I was cooking at the Water Grill, which is the job that I had right before.
Downtown
fish
seafood
restaurant.
Emporium. Yeah. Amazing. Really good.
Yeah.
Great seafood.
Yeah. But Joachim would come there, quite a bit, bring his wife. Come with other chefs in the company just to have a meal or just come by himself, whatever. And, we kind of struck up a relationship. Of course, I had met him before. Every once in a while, would come through the kitchen at Le Cirque and I would say, hey, if you ever need somebody out in California, give me a call, like stupid shit, like when I was a kid.
I still say stupid shit.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. So anyway, we would talk and stuff and he'd, at one point he called me to his office and this is after he had moved Patina downtown to the Walt Disney Concert Hall, and he was like, it was announced that was going to happen. Maybe it hadn't happened yet, but he was like wondering maybe you want to work for me. And I was like, I don't know, chef. I'm honored, but I really kind of would see that as almost like a lateral move. But what I really want to do is open my own place. And he was like, and he totally understood, of course, because he was in that
same position
at one point.
Yeah.
So anyway, we moved on from that, and then, I was looking, I couldn't find a spot, and then I figured I'm gonna call Joachim. He's a friend, he seems to have no trouble finding real estate, so I called him up, and he said, yeah, I have somebody, I can refer you to someone, and so he gave me a name. I called that person, looked around more and more and more, didn't find anything that I suited to what I wanted to do, and then maybe another month passes, and then he calls me again. He goes, hey, why don't you meet me? There's a Pete's coffee shop over where he lives near in San Marino, and I live in the same sort of area. So we met there in the morning, and we're sitting there, and every other person that walks in the door, because it's his hometown, knows him.
It's like, oh,
yeah,
hey, Jackie.
And we can't talk about shit. So he's like, all right, let's get out of here. Let's go to my house. Follow me. So we go to his house, and we sit down, and he goes, I want to offer you the original Patina. We moved out of it. They tried to make a go of it as a private catering facility or an event space, and it just really didn't, it wasn't
that's the same.
A hard thing to do.
Yeah.
And so he said, he goes, you call Bob, because he used Bob. He goes, you call Bob, he'll beat the bushes, put a little money together, and you open a restaurant,
it's that easy.
Great.
This is easy.
Yeah, and I left the meeting. I was so elated because I was I had everything I wanted.
Yeah.
It had been a fine dining restaurant for many years. They just put a whole bunch of money into it. Built a beautiful kitchen, the whole thing. I was beautiful wine cellar, perfect. And that's really how it came about. And it was really, that's one of the reasons why we called it Providence, because that, the whole thing, if you think about the sequence of events that had to unfold in order for that to happen, it was Providence.
Well, I think it was because he respected you and knew you and knew that there was a direction going.
Yeah.
We're eating a lobster roll now.
Yeah.
So
this is a Connie Ted's warm lobster roll.
We chew on the podcast, so it's fine. So let's go back to Le Cirque for a second. I think it was a Le Cirque. You made a foie gras dish for Julia Child.
How do you know that?
It's an obscure story. I researched you. I've got people. I got to tell you. There's this thing called Google.
Yeah.
It's fucking amazing. You can find out anything about anyone. So tell me that story about Julia Child and the whole foie gras.
Yeah. So one of my favorite cookbooks to this day, and it has been for 25 years, is this book called The Taste of France by Robert Frazon. And it's a, it's old school. It's a super old school cookbook. But if you look through it, there's amazing stuff in there about the country cuisine, the humble cuisine of France, but also what was going on in three Michelin star restaurants at that time. This is it was probably published the first time in the early 70s or mid 70s. So obviously everything was completely different. Paul Bocuse,
but it
wasn't
nouvelle cuisine at all.
Well, no, it was a little bit.
Okay.
I mean, Paul Bocuse is a young man, Verger's a young man, Georges Blanc, Alain Chappelle, all these guys are in that book. One of the recipes that's in that book is a whole roasted foie gras with verjus, where you roast the foie gras a little bit and then you add a whole bunch of grapes like on the stem,
yep.
And you add obviously some verjus to the pan, and you roast those things together, and then you serve you actually take some of the foie gras, some of the grapes after they're roasted, and you push them through a chinois or a sieve, along with some of the verjus and whatever fat has come out of the foie gras to make the sauce, and then you slice the foie gras and serve it. And I talked to Sylvain, the chef, and the Sota, and told him I really want to make this dish for Julia Chai when she comes in. Will you let me do it? And they said,
yes. Were you the outspoken sous chef who wanted to get like do your thing, or
no.
Like what was the idea?
I just wanted to make that for Julia Child.
That's awesome.
Just figured, like,
how was it?
It was great. I loved it. Loved it. No, I've never made it again. I made it once, and we went out there, and after the meal, all the cooks, all of us gathered around her table, and she was talking about it, she said something about the foie gras, how wonderful the foie gras was. And Sota goes, there was one girl working in the kitchen who I still am in touch with to this day, but she doesn't work in the kitchen anymore. Her name was Jessica Delaney. And she goes, oh, Jessica made the foie gras for you. So funny.
You're like, oh, my God.
No, but I didn't care because I know,
As long as you knew, that was enough.
Yeah, but, oh, man, she's such a wonderful person. Like, just to have the opportunity to cook for her and have met her a few times. I mean, it was just... Oh my God, it was so incredible, because I was like one of those kids that grew up watching her and the Galloping Gourmet and
the Galloping Gourmet. I'm from Ottawa, Canada.
Yeah,
Galloping Gourmet was filmed in Ottawa, Canada.
Really?
I have no idea why. He stopped filming in the year I was born, 1971, but I'll still watch those episodes and be like, this guy's so gregariously weird. But like, the whole premise of the show was brilliant. Like, they pay him to travel, he takes a little video camera, takes a picture of an amazing, weird foie gras course, goes back to the studio in Ottawa, tries to make the dish, fucks it up almost on purpose because that's where the gags come in, makes a bunch of weird 1970s sexual innuendo, and it's hilarious.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I want to do a modern rendition of that. I'm working on that. I think it'd be fun.
Why not?
Could be over the top.
What's old is new again.
I know. Yeah. It's everything's being rebooted.
Yeah. I remember another time when I was there. So many great stories of the Cirque, but we did this dinner there. It was called the Dinner of the Millennium. Paul Bocuse, Roger Verger.
Was the Y2K dinner?
No, it was before. I think it was actually before that, but they just called it. The Dinner of the Millennium.
Yeah.
So it was Paul Bocuse, Roger Verger, Gerard Boyer, and Alain Ducasse were the chefs. Fucking crazy, right?
Ducasse pre-accident?
Yeah. Post.
Post?
Yeah. Because, Sylvain was his chef de cuisine at the Louis Cannes when they earned the third star. Yeah. And then he came over. Because at that time, like, Alain Ducasse was, like, the preeminent chef in the world. And he remains that way to this day. But anyway, it was an incredible dinner, and they all brought, like, just, Paul Bocuse brought two MOFs to do the dinner, and Roger Verger brought a couple of guys, his chef de cuisine, this guy named Serge Goulums, I think was his name. Gerard Boyer brought his son, who since he had been the chef of Le Criere's for a long time, and then Alain Ducasse brought a whole bunch of guys. Plus, Ducasse already had several guys in the Le Cirque kitchen, because Sylvain brought like three guys with him from the Louis Cannes. But that dinner was like, it was insane, Paul Bocuse made his soup Bocuse for 200 people.
Wow.
Roger Verger did a scallop dish with fennel, which I remember, which is incredible. Ducasse did a squab dish on a brochette. Like, he actually brought a rotisserie with him to cook the birds. It was insane. It was crazy.
How do you write off that?
I don't know. We flew it all over on the Concorde.
Concorde. Okay, well, obviously. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so somebody in the French government is footing the bill on that.
I remember,
one.
And the day before, we did a press event at the restaurant. So the dinner took place on Sunday. The press event was on Saturday at lunch. And Alain Ducasse had brought ortolan.
Oh, wow. Did everybody get a little hood?
Yeah.
Ortolan is the tiny little bird in fine French dining that's illegal.
Illegal, yeah. It's illegal to sell it.
Yeah, not to eat it, yeah, but to sell it.
Usually, so, you find them like if you have like a hunting club or something like that,
right,
or whatever. You can eat like, so if you have a
gourmand. Did you eat one?
No, I didn't eat one.
I've never eaten one.
We cooked them, and the chef brought the earthenware cocottes with him to roast them in. He brought these beautiful linen towels, which were embroidered with ortolan.
Okay, this that is you the most fucked up top thing of your head. Because this is a special like cowling hood napkin that you put over your head, so when you bite the tiny cooked bird, the juices don't like spray everywhere.
And also, so God doesn't see you.
God
enjoying
doesn't see
the
you
decadence
enjoying
of
yeah, the decadence
yeah.
of this beautiful little bird.
Yeah, and it was crazy.
Is so, God that all seeing?
Oh, I guess so.
I guess so.
Yeah.
Wow.
But I remember like that. So that, I mean, it was a spectacular lunch. It was crazy to be a part of it. And then the next day one of the first front pages of the New York Post was a picture of this socialite with like an ortolan like hanging out of her mouth with this thing over her head. And then we got a call from the FDA like, we'd like you, to know how yeah, you got those yeah. birds in the country.
We hunted them.
Yeah, it was
they
crazy.
They were just here. We're not selling them. It was a press event. Nobody got charged. Oh, that's crazy. So Providence specializes obviously in fish,
right,
and is a very seasonal, ever-changing menu. I want to talk about a little bit about fish sustainability and the idea of farmed fish versus wild-caught and the status of the oceans as it stands, because you know a lot about this. But really, I just want to know right off the bat is, so you get a stunning, stunning, let's say a grouper in.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes in. Give me the, from that point to portioning, what's going on?
Well,
how is it treated and how is it cared for?
Yeah. Well,
what's the root of the fish?
Yeah, if it's a big guy, if it's a big one, like we would, we'd scale the fish first and then we'd save the cheeks and we'd save the collars and we.
And how are you? Are you rinsing it?
The fish itself?
With water?
No, not really. Just scale it. You know, scale it, and then we would, like I said, take off the head, eviscerate the fish. Everything we get whole and, you know, intact. Except for a few fish, which almost never come to market intact.
I mean, tuna is
and
hard to
salmon,
buy
things like that.
Yeah.
We would scale it, we would gut it, we would take off the head, we'd save the cheek, cut the cheek off on the bone. Cut the collars off, and then we brine those. And then we, like right now, we're doing a thing where we marinate them overnight in shiokoji, liquid shiokoji. And then
shiokoji is inoculated sushi rice.
Yeah.
It's live culture rice. That basically, how would you explain with a flavor?
Just brings umami.
It kind of makes things more feel, kind of forces almost a good, positive dry age flavor to things. A pronouncing of flavors, umami.
Yeah. So then we steam that, and then we take all the meat off, and we make like a little fish taco in a nasturtium leaf, with a house smoked. We make our own chipotle in the restaurant, and then we take the house made chipotle and make adobo sauce with it. Then we mix that with creme fraiche, and we mix that with the collar meat of the fish, and then we fry up little like tempura bits in a pan, and we add that to the taco, so it tastes like a fish taco, like that you would get here in Los Angeles somewhere, except it's, you know, it's two bites or one bite.
Yeah.
And so that was what we would do with the collar and the rest of it. And then we would fillet that fish, maybe like depending upon what it kind like what the skin was like.
So
we might take it off, we might leave it on.
But then the storage of that, are you filleting down to portions or are you keeping them whole? And obviously you're motoring through them pretty quickly, but like, storage is always interesting to me.
So
like,
it all depends. You know, that's a good question, because you're right. My belief is, like, it's always best to have the fish under your roof than have it under someone else's roof.
Yeah.
So if you know when that fish is coming in, like, you know, if you've got a fishmonger that'll tell you, like, yeah, I'm getting black cod on Wednesday, then you buy, like, if you need black, you know, I would buy the black cod and the black cod for Wednesday through, say, Monday, when he's getting more fish. I would buy all of it on Wednesday, and then I would bring the fish into the house, and we would like process it to the point that's appropriate, and that depends on the species. So like, for instance, black cod, to me that fish stays better off the bone. So we would fillet it all, we brine our black cod, and then we would just lay it out on sheet pans with parchment paper on top, wrap it up really well with plastic, and then just leave it. I don't believe in icing fish. I actually think it's very detrimental, actually, to the quality of the
fish. It can bruise it. So yeah. I was in Newfoundland recently, which is East Coast for is really the epicenter of Canadian fisheries.
Yeah.
In a little tiny place called Fogo Island Inn, which is this beautiful inn. And I was giving a lecture on pickling, and we started talking about fishing and fisheries and all that sort of stuff. And this guy suddenly challenged, he's a really older guy. He's really, you can tell he's very academically smart on these things. He talked to me about washing fish. Well, it ends up he's like this amazing award-winning scientist and professor about rinsing fish with high salinity water. Regular water immediately hits the fish on a fillet and makes it destroys the smoother texture of it, and it kind of tears it, and it results in this really, it's about a quarter of an inch of mushy stuff before you get to the firmer fillet again, no matter how fresh it is. And it was really interesting. Like, he was just talking about different salinity levels in water that were perfect for fish.
Right.
And then he was saying never iced fish. Right. It just needs to be cold.
Yeah.
But it's funny that, you know, 47-year-old chef, I'm still learning stuff every day, but that's my most... that to me is the best part of this occupation for me, is that I can never get bored.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. So right now it's May. What fish are running that you're uber excited about?
Well, I mean, right now we have incredible California king salmon.
Yeah.
That's being harvested, like, you know, as far south as Ventura and then all the way up to the, you know, border of Oregon.
Yeah.
And so we have incredible, you know, the fish is amazing.
Yeah.
You know, like, to me, like, you know, wild salmon is definitely, you know, one of the best fish that we have in the United States. To me, it's like a real shame that it gets forced out of the market by, you know, by farm-raised fish from all over the world that's half the price and half the quality and has half the flavor and half the integrity and is less than half as good for the world. You know, so, you know, that kind of stuff just, tears my heartstrings. Because especially, you know, like, you know, when you know, especially if you know the people that are harvesting the fish and you know what they go through to bring that fish to market, and then to be, you know, in their own country, be asked out of the market by imported goods, is really shitty. You know, it's a shitty thing that we've done to the American fisheries and to American fishermen and women. And so, you know, to me, that's a wrong that it's going to take a long time to right, and probably never will be.
Yeah, but I mean, fish is a great example of how cheapening the cost of food to a very low level leads to a lot of problems.
A lot of problems.
And that we don't realize them for decades afterwards.
Well, people expect it, you know, it's the same, you know, same thing with agriculture and, you know, and produce and stuff. You know, people expect tomatoes in December and strawberries in December and they, you know, and asparagus in, you know, in, I don't know, November and, all, you know, just craziness, you know?
Yeah.
And it's because, you know, because now we live in a world where everything is no more than 24 hours away, and that's tough. You know, that creates a lot of issues, especially in the food world. And, you know, it's, I don't know. That's why, you know, that's why to me it's, like, so important that, especially, you know, and here, all the restaurants that I'm involved in, like, that we only sell wild fish, and we work as hard as we can to source it, you know, as close to the, you know, as close to the fisherman as possible. You know, if at all possible and when possible, we buy directly from
oysters,
the fishermen.
A lot of your oysters be farmed here, wouldn't they?
Yeah, and that's an important distinction. You know, like, when you talk about the aquaculture of, like, bivalves, so mussels, clams, oysters, all of those things, they have a restorative impact on the environment.
They're regenerative.
And they, you know, like, for instance, in New York Harbor, there's this project that's been going on for years that, you know, once they find funding, hopefully we'll be able to do it. It's called the Billion Oyster Project. Theory being that if they were able to put a billion oysters back into Hudson Bay as there once were, that water would be, you know, restored, you know, to the point where it was, like, before industrialization. Like, you know, so you take a billion oysters, you put them in an estuary like that, and you roll back the clock on all the damage that we had done.
So why is that?
Because oysters are filter feeders,
yeah,
and so all they do is they draw water in and they expel water, and they take what they need out of the water to survive, and in the process they filter the water and purify the water. There was a time in this country where there were enough oysters in the Chesapeake Bay to filter every drop of water in that bay in one day. That's how big a population was in the bay, you know, and that's that's only one of the positive impacts that shellfish have on on wetlands and estuaries. Like the entire Gulf region was filled with massive shoals of wild oysters back in the day. Many of those have been harvested, but one of the big reasons why you've got the Army Corps of Engineers and down there trying to figure out ways to keep keep New Orleans from falling beneath the water and trying to repair the wetlands and the oysteries is because we took all those beds out. Those beds were an integral part of that whole system, and protected beaches from erosion and kept the sand and the earth where it needed to be. And so it's incredible, and it's only with hindsight, hundreds of years on, that we truly realize the impact of what we've done.
But we do know the impact now. Very, very destructive. I know I am not a geologist, but I've always thought about when are we going to know what's really happening within the earth as we take out all the oil?
Yeah.
Wouldn't you think that plays some sort of a function down
there?
Yeah,
think of a balloon.
Yeah, or think of an engine because it's shifting and moving and... Yeah. I don't know. It's always terrifying. Well, fucked everything up, Michael.
It's true, we did. We really got a lot of work to do. But even California, the fact that we have a California king salmon season now, whereas for years, there was, the returns were horrible, so part of that is a function of environment. Part of it is a function of, say, drought, so if you have a bad drought year and, in the streams and the rivers that those salmon return to, if they're very dry and they can't get back, you're going to have
not much of a spawn.
Right. You're going to have bad returns 3-4 years down the road. But the other big part of it, and this is where we, have really fucked it up, is habitat destruction. So you start putting dams in on these rivers and the salmon can't return to their spawning grounds. And then suddenly,
unless they're super salmon.
Yeah, exactly. They're not. They usually can't. That depletes the runs, year after year after year. There's, luckily there's people that are, working on restoring habitat in California. That coupled with the fact that we've had some good rain, in the last couple of years, are probably going to make for great salmon runs in the coming years.
So shrimp, spot prawns, all of those are very, very sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
They regenerate really quickly. Mm-hmm. There again, they help to restore habitat like bivalves do. Yet shrimp and spot prawns are thought to be luxurious items.
Yeah.
Why are spot prawns so expensive?
Well, one of the reasons is the cost of the fishery.
Right.
It's very expensive to be a spot prawn fisherman. The last I heard of a spot prawn license being up for sale, a permit, in the state of California was $800,000 to purchase a permit.
Wow.
Now, so that's a lifetime permit. If you want to put the money into it, you might be able to find one. I think there's only 11 in the state or something like that. It's somewhere between 9 and 11.
I may have to buy a spotprawn.com in advance of buying that.
It's insane.
I don't have that money.
Yeah. It's insane.
That is crazy. But they regenerate pretty quickly. So wouldn't there be an impetus to get more farming and more fisheries behind it?
Yeah, I don't know. When you think about it,
sea urchins everywhere. Why is it so expensive?
Because it's a lot of work. It's
it's dangerous. It's dangerous.
And if you think of a sea urchin, a big California sea urchin might weigh a pound and a half or so. But when you open it up and at the end of the day, the edible portion of that is maybe 2 ounces, 3 ounces.
Yeah.
And, weather, wind, right now, usually we would have live sea urchin here pretty much every day of the year if we could. But it's not always possible, if the wind is bad and the weather is bad, then the fishermen just can't get out.
Do you bring in fish ever from Japan and places like that?
I do at Providence.
Yeah.
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 And, for sashimi, we have this source now that they're ridiculous. It's all done via WhatsApp. And so Thursday afternoon, they, get in touch with us around 2:00 and they start sending us photos of fish that are still alive, wild fish that are still alive in Toyasu Market, which is what, was Tsukiji, now it's Toyasu. They moved it and renamed it. And we pick and choose what we want, and then we get it the next day. So Friday, as a matter of fact, so as we sit here right now, it's Friday, it's 4:00 in the afternoon. They probably delivered at 2:30. So we were looking at the fish on our phones on WhatsApp at 3:30 in the afternoon on Thursday, and now it's in the kitchen at Providence. And those fish were alive in Tokyo 23 hours earlier.
And that goes to how much restaurants and chefdom has changed and globalism has really impacted our menus. I mean, that's insane.
Yeah. But honestly, like, if I had my druthers, I would rather have, you know, Wild Yellowtail from here in California caught by my friend Eric Hodge on Rod and Reel.
But it's just not available
not
that
right now.
Often.
Not right now. And, you know, and it probably won't be for several weeks, you know, until the water, you know, sort of like warms up. Like, I was actually talking to this guy, Eric Hodge, who's one of the fishermen that we deal with a lot, about maybe like 2 hours ago. He said he went out fishing yesterday, left the harbor, it was like 48.9 degrees in Santa Barbara Harbor, which is ridiculously cold. And, you know, he fished for 6 hours in 9-foot swells and spent half the day puking. And this is a guy that's lived his life
on the,
on the water. And that's how bad.
What'd he catch?
He did that. He was 8 hours out for 150 pounds of fish, which by his standards is nothing.
It's a
like
bad,
for him, a
bad
good,
day.
Yeah, for him, a good trip is you know, anywhere between 600 and 1,000 pounds of rockfish.
Wow.
And stunning and perfect. And he's been working for the last couple of weeks with a guy, actually, Japanese. He's had a Japanese mate on his boat teaching him how to perform ikijime on fish so that he can deliver, like, just stunning, perfect
so
quality.
So explain that. That's severing a spinal cord.
Yeah. So you usually, I mean, you either notch the tail of the fish or notch the head of the fish to expose the spinal column. And then there's you know, just like you and I, the back of our vertebrae, there's like a little there's a narrow hole that our spinal cord runs through. And fish have that same sort of thing. And so when you perform ikijime, what you do is you expose that by either notching the tail or the head, and then you take a long, thin wire and you force it into the spinal, with a little chamber where the spinal cord is, and deadens the nerves of the fish. And what it really does is it suspends rigor in the fish so that you can use the fish sooner. And the technique was really most relevant to like sushi restaurants where, like, especially in Japan, you know, Tokyo, Kyoto, places like that, where most sushi chefs are buying live fish, at least some of the species are live when they get them in the morning. So they perform ikijime as part of the butchering process so they can serve them that evening.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because they don't have to let rigor naturally relax itself.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And when you perform that on a fish, it's a crazy thing because you can, you know, you can hold your hand on the fish and, you know, like any living being, you know, you can feel the muscle and, you know, but when you pass that spike, like up the spinal cord of the fish, you can actually like literally feel it relax under your hand when you do it. It's crazy. It's really odd.
Wow. That's like the legalization of pot.
Yeah.
California's seen a lot more relaxed. They're no longer so anxiety
taught. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But they're alive, which is good. Don't do that
sort
to
of
California
alive.
People.
Yeah. It's crazy. I mean, the first time I did that, I was in Kyoto and I was on this like culinary fellowship, and we were in a shop, and the guy's shop was maybe 200 or 300 square feet. It was a tiny little shop, and it was all the walls were ringed with saltwater tanks. And the fisherman would bring him live wild fish, and then he would let them sit in that tank for at least 24 hours before he would sell them to sort of like have them calm down from the trauma of being caught.
Let's get used to your small new ocean.
And then, you know, when he would get orders from restaurants, he would pull the fish out that morning, perform ikijime, and then deliver the fish in that state.
Wow.
And then the restaurants would take it from there.
Let's go to sushi for a little bit, and let's talk about the new popularity that's come finally to the states of aging fish.
Yeah.
So what's your take on that?
I mean,
what's it doing? Are they doing it on the bone? They're not. Usually.
Yes.
They are.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it depends.
But
you can do it either way.
You can do it either way.
But like, you know, I think there's this like myth that, you know, that persists that, you know, fish has to be, you know, you didn't get it yesterday or wasn't caught yesterday. Well, the truth is like, in very few circumstances are you ever getting fish that was caught like 24 hours earlier, or fish that was alive 24 hours earlier. So once, obviously, like once a fish dies, from that point on, it's all about handling. Like, so for instance, when we are, you know, we work with a lot of local fishermen, and we get the fish, you know, we get fish that's caught just, you know, sometimes less than 24 hours out of the water, sometimes still alive when we get it. But we order the fish in large quantities so that I don't have to rely on anyone else. You know what I mean? I would rather buy from, you know, my friend Eric Hodge or any of the other fishermen that we work with and buy large amounts from him and then hold that fish for 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 days even. But it's all about handling once you've done it. So when we, like, for instance, get like large amounts of rockfish from Eric, we will we'll scale the fish, we'll behead the fish, we'll gut the fish, we'll clean the fish out, you know, so that everything is all the blood is removed from the fish, everything. We even trim off the tail and then leave everything on the bone. We'll pack the cavity of the fish with paper towels.
Yep.
Put it on a sheet with parchment paper, put parchment paper over the top of it, wrap it really well, and then we fillet the fish as we need them. So if we figure we need, let's say we have 15 fish and we need 5 fish on Friday, 5 fish on Saturday, 5 fish on Sunday, we will butcher them that way. So we'll, you know, we'll butcher the 5 fish that we need for today, and then we usually brine everything that we use. If it's like, if it's sashimi, it depends on the species.
You wet brine everything?
It depends.
Okay.
So like the fish that we use for sashimi, most of the time, or all the time really, we just sprinkle with sea salt, and then you let the fish sweat for 15 or 20 minutes, depending upon the thickness of the fillet.
Okay. And then you're rinsing it, or yeah, just patting it dry?
You rinse it, pat it dry, and then done.
Okay.
And then we let the fish dry for an hour or two before we cut it for sashimi.
Okay.
Black cod and that particular fish, we use a wet brine, and we actually put a little bit of sugar in the brine as well as aromatics.
Okay.
When we do rockfish, like whiter fish, like very white flesh fish, like say California rockfish or white sea bass or striped bass from the East Coast, we brine in usually a 7% salt solution.
Okay.
So, yeah.
That's a high percentage.
That's pretty high. Yeah. Well, I mean, you figure seawater is usually around 3.5-4.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit more than that.
Like a typical chicken brine that you do at home is probably between 2 and 3%.
Yeah.
Usually. And yeah. So 7th on the salty side, but I mean, it's not spending that much time in there.
A couple of hours.
Okay.
And it depends on the thickness.
That's the difference. I mean, they're talking about, you know, the old school brining poultry was 24 hours or 36 hours. No, so.
To me, I think, like, especially fish like white sea bass or halibut or striper, things like that, like larger fish like that, like once you brine them, and especially if you just let them sit a day or two after you brine them. So if like the way that we do that is, you know, you brine the fish, then you pull it out, you pat it dry, because a wet brine, there's no need to rinse it. You just pat it dry. And then you put it on a stainless steel rack, cover it with cheesecloth, and just let this fish sit in the refrigerator, and it sort of dries out and it gets tacky. It creates a pellicle on the flesh of the, on the surface. Then when you go and roast that fish, like grill it over a charcoal fire.
It's going to color beautifully.
Yeah.
And yeah.
And
it's because of the
flavor.
Removal of that moisture has been inherently important.
Yeah.
So.
Been super important. Also, it allows you to cook the fish a little bit less and at a lower temperature and still have it be nice and flaky, which is really important, because that brining sort of begins to denature the fish just a little bit. And
are you cooking any fish sous vide? At the restaurant?
No. Yeah. The only fish that I've ever really liked in sous vide is monkfish.
Yeah.
And, you know, because
monkfish likes a longer cook time at a very specific temperature, and then it actually really likes to rest. I mean, all fish like to rest, but monkfish likes to rest.
Yeah.
It needs to rest, so.
Yeah, we almost all the fish we do is over either a charcoal fire or, and all the fish here is charcoal fired at Connie and Ted's. And at Providence, it's all mostly charcoal fire and some things we cook in a pan.
Connie and Ted's for a casual seafood emporium, as I'm now dubbing it. Yeah. I don't know if that's the official language.
I like it.
Has a beautiful range in the center. That's awesome. Mm. Very cool. So how many courses is the typical Providence menu now?
Well, I mean, we have 4, 7, or the chef menu, which is...
How
like
long is the chef menu?
15 or 16, something
like
that.
How many covers do you guys do a day? Or a night, typical?
Maximum is like 110 for us. We can't do more than that.
Average, but I mean, 110 times 16 is...
Oh, yeah.
A gazillion plates for a dishwasher.
Yeah.
That's a lot
of
plates.
Like tonight, you know, we'll definitely do over 1,000 plates served to the guests.
Yeah. Who runs the wine program?
Guy named David Osenbach.
Okay.
He's been with us for maybe five or six years now.
And it's grown to the budget that was prescribed by the initial partner.
Yeah. And, you know, he does an excellent job. Like,
but at this point, it's a good investment. People are going there for that.
Yeah.
I mean, they're going there to eat your food and
drink good wine. Yeah.
Have amazing hospitality at a world-renowned restaurant. But they're also going to drink wine that's amazing.
Of course.
So,
and you know, we, for a long, like the first 10 years we were open, we had one sommelier, And he's like very, he's like young, like a young Turk, like really super intense. He actually is a partner in a restaurant called Cali, which is just a little bit further down from us on Melrose now. And he runs the front of the house and the wine program, and his partner Kevin is the chef. But so he was there for a long time, and he has very own, like very specific sort of thing, like really like, you know, like Gewürztraminers, Rieslings, you know, like which pairs very well with our food.
Yeah.
So our wine is very like Gewürztraminer, Riesling, Burgundy, white Burgundy heavy. And then and he also liked it, you know, Drew, our old sommelier, more of a New World kind of guy. Not entirely. I mean, obviously I had a lot of respect for Old World wines too. But the sommelier we have now is very much like an Old World guy, which I love. I love Old World wines.
So do I. Yeah. You have a number of loves that I know about. I know you like really good bourbon.
Yes.
I know you like really good European old school wines. Mm-hmm. And I know you love the Grateful Dead.
Yes.
Tell me about your love of the Grateful Dead.
I mean, you know, that started when I think the first time I saw him was like 13. So it's 36 years ago now.
You saw the Dead when you were 13?
Yeah.
Wow.
First time. With a family friend.
That's cool.
Yeah. And then, you know. And
old
then
Uncle Buck was yeah. not to be trusted, but took you to the Grateful yeah. Dead. That's awesome.
But then I started, you know, I went to as many shows as I could while Jerry was alive, like up until the time that I got really serious about cooking, which was, you know, basically like when I graduated, a little after I graduated high school. But I used to go a lot.
I still have kids though who are like working kitchens, and they're like, "Hey man, I got to take 2 weeks off to go follow fish around." I'm like,
oh, yeah.
"Fuck you, do.
Yeah.
Welcome to the world of professional work.
Yeah.
You can't do that.
No, you can't.
This is not like it's that." True.
So now, you know, like for instance, there's four shows coming up. There's two next week.
Oh, I know. Suzanne Goyen told me yeah. the Hollywood Bowl.
Yeah, and two at the Hollywood Bowl.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, I can't go to one of them. I just found out. Because, I mean, even though I have tickets for it, I have to give it to someone, a miracle to someone. Because it's the night of the Michelin release.
Oh, really?
It's June 3rd. And that's the first show at the Hollywood Bowl, so I can't go. Because they asked me to cook at that event.
Oh, you're cooking at the release.
So I have to be an adult.
It's weird to be cooking at a show where you're probably up for two or three. How many stars do you guys have now?
Two. Yeah.
Are you vying for a third? Does it matter?
I mean, to me it matters. You know,
it does matter.
Like at some point, like, who knows? You know, I mean, it's like any kind of thing I like to talk about before the guide is released, because I haven't been in L.A. for almost 10 years now.
Yeah.
And, I mean, when I left, we had two stars, and I think we're a better restaurant now. You know, God only knows. You know,
yeah.
I know... I don't know. I don't know.
we know that. I mean, patina is fine dining.
Yeah.
In a very modern sense of the word, there's been a shedding of formality in fine dining that's
yeah.
important, because I think that exudes authenticity that's now possible.
Yeah.
And zeal.
Yeah.
That wasn't allowed.
Yeah.
In sort of really yeah. rigid formal settings before. I think Michelin's kept up with that. But, the attainment of stars and keeping them up just seems relentless to me and exhausting to me.
Yeah, but I don't know, you know, I mean, I think I know you pretty well. I know you take your food seriously, and I think that's what it is. You know what I mean? Like, to me, it's all about just you care about every, you know, the quality of every single dish that leaves the line. You know what I mean? I mean, to me, that's what it is. You know what
it
I mean?
Is.
Like, it
yeah.
doesn't matter who's in the dining room, in a sense. Like, you have your own standards, and this is the way you want it done, and this is the way it's going to look, and this is the way it's going to taste, and all of that kind of stuff. And, you know, I honestly think that's what a Michelin star restaurant is. It's like being, you know, just being serious about, very serious about what you're doing at any level. And that, so it doesn't, you know, that means whether it's a level like Connie and Ted's or a restaurant like Providence, like, you know. And that's what's great about where food is now. I think,
and what's really great about LA, because I find that professionalism and attention to detail in Los Angeles, in maybe a later blooming city in the world of dining, you see that in taco shops
yeah.
now, and in that sort of attention to detail and professionalism
right.
that people can bring. Now we understand that you can bring that to anything.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, proven in a lot of ways by really good coffee shops.
Yeah.
When everybody said Starbucks was going to close all the coffee shops that weren't going to exist, somebody went, scratched their head and said, screw that, I can do a better job than
yeah.
that. and pay attention and learn more every day about it and push mm-hmm. ourselves and push the boundaries. And that can be it for a taco shop, it can be for an oyster bar like the one we're in,
yeah.
or it can be for Providence.
Right.
So, but LA is so good for that right now.
I agree.
I think Night and Market getting a nod for, Chris getting
best
a nod
list,
for
yeah.
best wine list was yeah. was game-changing in a lot of yeah. ways. Because it's not a huge wine list, but it's really thoughtful and it means something.
Right.
And, you know, this is a guy who took over half of his dad's restaurant
yeah.
to start his own career, mm. which is brings tears to your eyes in a lot of ways because it's beautiful. Mm. So, I don't know. LA is just on the...
That's what I told Christy, like, when I saw him after the awards. I was like, you know, because I go to Night Market a lot. And every time I go, I learn something about wine. And, like, that's incredibly important. It doesn't matter if, you know, like, you don't need a guy in a black jacket with tails and a test van around his neck to know to be serious about wine. And that's exactly what that award or that nomination meant
should
to a place like
yes,
Night and Market.
And it's what that award should be for.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is, it's about what you're serving and how you serve it. And it's about educating everybody in the way that everybody wants to be educated.
Yeah.
They don't want to be talked down to. We all want to learn.
Yeah.
And that's the great thing. And I think that we're all in chefdom these days. The ones who really care about this stuff are just constantly learning and constantly teaching. And, you know, that's the ball of yarn we weave.
Yeah.
It's fun.
Yeah.
It's fun. So it's cool. Well, Michael, this has been awesome.
It has
Thank
been.
You for having me.
Yeah.
That's
a lot
Connie
of fun.
And Ted's.
Of course.
Thanks
for coming to Connie and Ted's. Thank you.
Good luck at the Grateful Dead shows.
Thank you very much.
And the Michelin Awards.
I can't wait.
High five.
Thank you.